Case number 21-1094, United States of America versus John Bass. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Goetz, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, Andrew Goetz for the United States. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Extreme variances are permitted only for especially deserving cases. That's true for above-guideline variances. That's equally true for below-guideline variances. There was no sufficient justification for reducing defendant John Bass's sentence below not only his guideline range, but also his mandatory minimum of life in prison. The opposite was true here. The crimes were vile, and his reasons for release were decidedly ordinary. The district court's decision here should therefore be reversed. Now let's start with the circumstances of the offense. This was a capital murder case. The defendant here was convicted of premeditated murder, one of the most serious crimes in our system. And he not only committed one murder, he committed two, ordering the murder of his brother and then murdering the hitman to cover up that murder. And he did this all while leading an extensive drug organization for the better part of a decade. And it wasn't just murder. This organization kept its workers in line through violence, and John Bass personally tortured one of them when he suspected that worker of stealing from the organization. John Bass and his other co-conspirators took the man aside, shot him in the chest, doused him with alcohol, set him on fire, and tormented him with a hot poker while Mr. Bass said, "Let's see what burning flesh smells like." And those circumstances are important because they show why virtually all of the 3553A factors here cut against the district judge's decision and did not support the 20 or 30 year below guideline variance.
I might agree with you if I was the district judge, but as an appellate judge, we have a pretty highly deferential standard of review. So I wonder if I've seen plenty of upward and downward variances. More often we see upward variances, I'd say, where I've said, well, the 3553A factors, I might have balanced them differently were I the district judge, but as an appellate judge, we have this deferential standard of review and it seems to me to fall within the range of reason. So when I say that for upward variances, why, under just basic neutral principle, shouldn't we apply the same deferential standard here?
A couple answers to your question. One is that same deferential standard here does apply, and we're not arguing otherwise. It is a deferential standard, and it's reserved only for outlier cases. Only outlier cases here are reversed as substantively unreasonable. And this case falls in that outlier bucket. I mean, we're talking about a defendant who has the ultimate crime of conviction here, premeditated murder, who's getting 20 or 30 years below that, not just guideline range, but mandatory minimum. And I do want to address that mandatory minimum point because it shows that there's even a stronger anchoring effect here in that life sentence. We're not just talking about the Sentencing Commission's judgment that a life sentence is appropriate. We're talking about Congress's judgment. So there's a stronger anchoring effect towards that life sentence. And even without that mandatory life sentence, there still has to be a sufficiently significant justification.
Does your argument depend? I mean, we're just debating kind of the facts. Does the argument depend on the scope of, I guess, the variance, which here, I don't know the exact number of months, but it was like 260 to 270 months that he's now served, and as compared to a life sentence. I thought, thinking about it in my head, what would the government's position be if it was a defendant whose guidelines range was actually only 270 months, but that the district court varied upward to impose a life sentence? Would the government, you know, have the same basic position that would be a highly questionable upward variance to go from 270 months to a life sentence as compared to a life sentence down to 270?
So the answer to your question is yes, and we've actually lost that argument. If the court looks at United States versus Aleo, that's exactly the circumstance this court, your Honor, is describing, where I think the guideline range was something like 235 to 293. The district judge varied upward to 720 months, and this court unanimously reversed that as substantively unreasonable. So I think the answer to your question is is yes, and for the same circumstances, the same reasons as here, that would be reversed as substantively unreasonable and was reversed as substantively unreasonable.
There's no question that the crimes were awful. But what I hear you saying is that fact in and of itself should disqualify him from getting the release. And some may agree with that, but I think that there is discretion. I mean, there's no rule that says that this procedure doesn't apply in these types of cases. So you end up having to look at the particular defendant. And the judge did a pretty thorough job of explaining why this was the extraordinary case in his mind. Why don't we look at those factors as well?
So, Your Honor, there are a few answers to your question. I think, one, we're not arguing that he's categorically ineligible here. So, I mean, that much I think we can all agree on. Two is, we're just asking this court to apply the same standard it always does for below-guideline variances. I think this would be a much tougher case if, say, this defendant was 80 years old and had terminal cancer. So I think we probably wouldn't be standing here. What we're saying is that the degree of the variance here for a 51-year-old, otherwise healthy defendant who was supposed to serve a mandatory life sentence just wasn't supported by a sufficiently significant justification. And then the answer to the third part of your question, Your Honor, is we're not quibbling with the procedural adequacy of the district court's decision here. It's 26 pages. It is thorough. What we're arguing is actually the same argument we made in Robinson with the same district judge, that these facts of the case did not permit the extent of this below-guideline variance. I mean, if we step back and looked at the reasons the district court gave for this variance, family circumstances. This court said in both Pepl and Boucher that ties to family members is not the type of reason that typically justifies a below-guideline variance, much less one this significant. So we already have case law saying that one of the main categories this district court relied on really shouldn't have applied in this way. Same is true of the defendant's coursework. It's admirable that the defendant was doing coursework, but coursework really shouldn't compensate for premeditated murder, something this heinous. I mean, this is not a parole power, despite the district court saying that it is. We're just asking that the same standard apply here as applied in Robinson and all this court's other substantive reasonableness.
Do you think that you mentioned the parole power point? The district judge mentioned that in an opinion that was issued after the appeal was raised. Do we even have jurisdiction to look at that opinion because it was issued after the notice of appeal, I think?
The short answer is probably not, but the court doesn't need to for that argument because the district court also said the same thing at the hearing here, that he viewed himself as having a parole power. And he said that in other cases too, which occurred before the notice of appeal was filed.
And I take it the United States' position is that misrepresents the nature of this provision, the statutory provision, and why is that? Is it because of the extraordinary circumstances language?
So the answer is yes, we think that misrepresents the nature of this provision. It's not just because of the extraordinary circumstances provision. I mean, parole just differed both in substance and in form. I mean, parole was built into the sentences at the time. It also had political accountability because it rested in the executive branch. It also had safeguards because parole could be revoked in ways that supervised release cannot. Supervised release, if you look at 3583, is capped at actually a very low sentence. Parole wasn't capped in the same way. I'd also point out that it's very strange to start talking about parole here when this was a life without parole sentence. Even under the parole system, this would have been life without possibility of release. So to start talking about parole, it doesn't make any sense. Generally, it doesn't make any sense here. So that comment and the district court's comments in other cases just show the district court here is fundamentally misapplying the legal standard in this context.
Could I ask some questions about your position now? You agree that this compassionate release statute would apply even though he was convicted and sentenced to life without release, right? You said it's not categorically excluded. Is that right?
I'll say that that's not quite right. We just don't think the court needs to go there here, Judge Rogers.
You're not arguing it then. Because you have an amicus brief that argues it.
So,
right? They argue that against that argument.
We're not arguing.
To me, we don't need to look at that amicus at the point that are made in the amicus brief because you're not arguing that it categorically precludes it. I think you can make a strong argument that it's relevant without saying that it categorically excludes it. If we say it categorically excludes it, you're going to have some 90-year-old person who should be in hospice who categorically can't get compassionate release. You're just declining to argue that, or are you rejecting that, or you're preserving that argument? That's what I'm asking.
I think we're declining to argue that because we don't think the court needs to go there, because it does have an anchoring effect either way, Judge Rogers. I think Your Honor's right.
When
that
you say anchoring effect, I wonder if it doesn't sort of misdirect the inquiry when it's sort of transferred into a number of years and then said, well, you've reduced a number of years. This is a categorical part of the sentence, right? Is life without release in the language that comes from the capital sentencing part of the statute? Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that would be one reason why it should at the very least be rare and perhaps never, is it for capital murder to...
The substance of the release, I take the argument to be, not that it categorically precludes, but that it... It's not just a numerical time reduction. It's a qualitatively different change of sentence, because in part of the sentence is, as an alternative to capital punishment, you're getting life imprisonment without release. Is that correct? Am I understanding that right?
I think that's right, Judge Rogers, and I think we probably could make a stronger argument here. Like you said, that presents the complicated case of the 90-year-old who is, you know,
right,
in hospice,
and we just don't.
Yeah.
Let me also ask you about extraordinary and compelling reason. Did you concede below that there was an extraordinary and compelling reason?
Yes, we conceded below. We're not contesting on appeal. The Department of Justice. I'm sorry, my red light is on. May I finish answering, Judge?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The Department of Justice's nationwide position has been that. A defendant who has a risk factor from COVID-19, given the heightened risk that incarcerated people face in prison from the virus, can show extraordinary and compelling reasons, and this defendant was obese. Now, he has since rejected the vaccine, but that happened after the district judge's ruling here. So at the time the district judge ruled, we conceded that he had shown extraordinary and compelling
reasons. Are we bound by the factual situation at the time of the ruling? I mean, the judge didn't seem to be bound by the factual situation at the time of briefing and went ahead and looked some things up on his own. Was that improper?
I don't know if that was improper. I think it's fair
to say. Can we send it back and ask him to do it some more?
I mean, that is one option, given the intervening circumstances, that the defendant has passed up the vaccine.
But if the intervening circumstances, would that affect the government's policy that you're bound to reflect here? Or would that policy preclude you from arguing at this point that there are no extraordinary and compelling reasons in light of change of circumstances?
So, Your Honor, the answer to your question is the government's policy would account for the vaccination status. Our position is once the defendant has been offered the vaccine, he can no longer show extraordinary and compelling reasons based on COVID-19. I think that's especially true.
If this case were litigated today, you would say that the facts are different and that there is no extraordinary and compelling reason for release?
That's correct, Your Honor. We would have that argument, and frankly, it would be...
So is there anything precluding us from sending this back and saying the facts have changed while this case was pending?
There's nothing that precludes the court from doing that. It may be the simpler course of action to remand on that basis, given that the facts have changed.
But if we did that, we would say nothing about the primary argument that you're making?
Not yet. I think that the court should at least retain jurisdiction, given that this district judge refuses to offer a stay. So it very well may come back. 34 out of 36 release decisions does not suggest that the result will be much different.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Doug Malkoff. I represent John Bass. I want to start off by addressing Judge Murphy's question that had to do with the post-clarification order that Judge Tarnow wrote that has just been referred to by Judge Rogers. I concede.
I was referring to his original order.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Proceed.
Yes. We concede that the district court was without jurisdiction to file a clarification as to the order post-appeal. Your decision in U.S. versus Harvey on April 28, case 20-1944, said just that. So
that seems like a good concession, because do you agree or disagree with the opinion's suggestion that a district court with a compassionate release motion is essentially a judicial parole board?
The issue of judicial parole board that has been discussed, I think, is perfect way for Judge Tarnow to describe the fact that he has looked at 22 years of rehabilitation change. The U.S. Supreme Court has said in a resentencing context what a person has done since the time of their original sentencing is highly probative and valuable, and it is akin in looking at what somebody's done with their prison time to what a parole board does.
That might suggest to me that the district court thought that this statute allows for reductions of sentences in a way that I'm not certain it does. The suggestion that it's analogous to a parole board suggests that it might be broadly available, but when I read the statute, it seems to me to say loud and clear that it's only designed for extraordinary circumstances, and there's a carve-out that suggests rehabilitation alone is not an extraordinary circumstance. So if I thought that was legal error, wouldn't that automatically be an abuse of discretion? We have plenty of cases saying legal errors are, like, per se abuses of discretion.
I don't think anything rose to the level of legal error in this case. I think that it was the context in which he was speaking at oral argument was looking at what this man has done with himself over 22 years compared to who he was on the day that the original sentence was imposed. The prosecutor here is taking issue with the court's 3553 analysis. That decision, as you know, is entitled to due deference. Deference in Webster is defined as courteous respect for or submission to another's opinion, wishes, or judgment. That's what deference is. And that is what this court owes to the district court when looking at it. Of course, abuse of discretion is your standard, and the abuse of discretion must look at what took place the day he made this decision, period. That's the extent of it. It means a clear error of judgment. He did not commit a clear error of judgment.
But don't you think, just thinking about it in terms of neutral principles and looking at variances upward and downward the same, I would imagine most defendants would think that they have a pretty strong case, even under an abuse of discretion standard of review, if a district court varied upward from about 260 or 270 months to a life without the possibility of parole. Sentence. I would think most defendants would say that's clearly an abuse of discretion, so why should we treat it differently when it's just a large downward variance?
I think the answer lies in what you alluded to at the beginning of your remarks, which is we may look at these and say, gosh, I wouldn't have done that if I were the district judge. I have a difference of opinion. I think that this was extreme, but given the deference standard, the due deference standard, you're bound and you're kind of hamstrung in a certain way, unless somebody's abusing their discretion.
I completely agree with that, but our cases do suggest that there is somewhat outward limit. I've dissented in several where there were upward variances, but those were much smaller than what this variance signifies, which is pretty substantial. And as Judge Rogers says, the initial sentence was categorically different.
That's true. So there's no question about that.
You agree that it's categorically different?
I'm not sure what you mean, Judge.
Well, you could say that what happened was this was, in effect, a reduction of so many years, all right? And
yes.
We argue about whether those years are a lot of years or just a few years or not enough years or a grossly obscene number of years reduction. That's an argument parses a little bit differently from saying you got a no-release life sentence instead of death, and to change that to a life sentence with the possibility of release is not just a number of years reduction. It is in some sense, but it's a categorically different sentence that's going out to him. And in that sense, one could argue, I think that's the nature of your opponent's argument in some sense, is that that's different. That's a profound difference. Not that it's so much of a difference that it doesn't weigh, but it weighs a little bit more heavily, or maybe substantially more heavily, than just a reduction in the number of years. That's the argument. Do you reject that argument?
I do. Congress had the opportunity to exclude death cases or mandatory life without parole cases when they were writing the statute for.
It's not an argument that says that it's excluded.
That's correct.
Argument that says the opposite of that.
I mean, it's Congress permissible. Any
it,
case.
But Congress didn't do it. But it did say it did. Permit us to look when we're reviewing this for arbitrary and capricious abuse of discretion kind of standard, right? Permitted us to look at what kinds of things are going to be taken into account and how much weight they're given. And if something that is an inherent part of the sentence, rather than just a graduation, but an inherent part of the sentence is no longer operative, you could say that's as something that has to be given particular weight in evaluating this kind of decision, this compassionate relief decision.
The U.S. Supreme Court in Williams versus New York, which is mentioned in Judge Tarnow's opinion at 12, said the punishment should fit the offender and not merely the crime. And the Supreme Court telling us that much gives us cause to believe that 3553 factors have to, in addition to thinking about the nature of the offense, think about the nature of the individual and the characteristics of the individual, the first of the seven 3553A factors. And that's what Judge Tarnow did, I think.
Fair answer. Let me ask a follow-up question, if I could, because you only have a certain amount of time. I don't want to traipse on too much of it. The district court, in its opinion, not this interim opinion of questionable provenance, but the initial opinion says it looked at the website and so forth and saw that things were getting worse at the prison. Was it wrong for him to do that?
I don't think it's wrong for a judge to employ his resources to study.
So in other words, it's legitimate for the judge to make a decision based on the facts as he sees them presently rather than when the motion was filed.
I think as up to the day of the decision, the judge can inform himself.
Why should it be different after the day of the decision? What if it's clear that using the same resources that the situation has changed, or at least it's clearly possible that the situation has changed? Why isn't it appropriate for us to send it back and have the judge apply the situation as it presently exists? It just seems kind of contrary to what Judge Murphy's calling sort of general principles of what's the best way to read this scheme.
I don't
think it seems odd to let somebody, especially somebody with this kind of a background, be released based on conditions that no longer exist.
I don't think that, first of all, this has been a very fluid situation, COVID-19. We all know that.
That's the nature of the system, I understand.
And
sometimes it's hard for the appellate scheme to work when facts change a lot.
We've all been looking at these, and it's been evolving very quickly, the landscape of law on this. But with respect to the vaccination issue, I thought it was probably improper when we to bring to the court's attention by letter that fact, in light of the fact that your job here is to decide if there was an abuse of discretion on the day that the decision was entered.
We can argue about whether it was proper to bring to our attention. What if we found out on our own, for instance, that there's nobody in the prison that has the disease anymore?
I think that
used the same sources that the district judge sua sponte used. I'm wondering whether there's something that keeps us from sending it back and saying, if you're going to look at that, look at the way it is now, not the way it was, because, as you say, it's a fluidly moving situation.
I think the answer to that question is that you, as appellate judges, are constantly bound by standards of review in looking at issues presented to you. And this is a case that has a standard of review, which is, did this judge abuse his discretion?
If it was moot and we found out that it was moot, we could send it back. How do we find that out? Somebody's got to tell us, right? You don't deny that we could find something that was moot after the case was decided.
No, I don't.
Okay, so if we could do that, I'm just working through this in my mind, because it's one of these strange situations where the facts are constantly changing, and it's sometimes anomalous to decide based on facts that have clearly changed. And you can't decide a case that's moot if it's changed, but if you're also allowed to look at subsequent facts before you decide and lead to a decision that's, you know, in some kind of ultimate sense, the wrong decision, just because of the technicalities of the time it takes for a case to be appealed, I just wonder why our coming to find out that the situation is significantly different oughtn't to warrant, at least in some circumstances, sending it back for further consideration. But you're saying categorically we're done once we'd have to look at the snapshot from 6 months ago or whenever it was.
I'm saying that you should treat this case as you have all of the other COVID-19 compassionate release decisions where judges have refused to grant compassionate release over and over. They have been affirmed, not with 26-page opinions.
Isn't it true that in those cases the nothing prevented the change of circumstances that the prisoner just apply again?
I don't.
This case is a little bit different. He's never been, well, he's only temporarily released. Is that true?
He was out for 9 days, I believe. The
judge. That's what I'm struggling with. If you can help me, great. If not, I'll work it out.
What do we do with the piece of information that he didn't accept the vaccine?
Ignore it. And do what you do in all your other cases, which is take the record that was made in the lower court appropriately, that which was the 26-page opinion, and evaluate it to decide whether within the confines of that, in the context of Judge Tarnow having been with this case with the greatest familiarity of anyone, of the facts of the John Bass case, having tried the case, heard the witnesses, sentenced him, handled the matter for over 20 years, 22 years, I think. Nobody is more familiar with the facts of who he was then and who he is now.
Counsel, if there had not been COVID-19, are you saying that it still would have been appropriate to find extraordinary circumstances and release him?
I think that we're bound by the facts we have here, and I don't see a circumstance that there's a flux in the law about what is permitted now, whether multiple stacked decisions, 924Cs, can be revisited as an extraordinary circumstance. I understand that there are two competing decisions in this in the Sixth Circuit right now.
Trying to drag us into that?
No, I'm not trying to drag you into that. I'm telling you that, and I've run out of time. Thank you for your questions.
Thank you.
I'm also not trying to drag you into that, Judge Rogers.
Thank you.
Judge Murphy, to answer your question about the legal error here, it wasn't just the mention of parole and the use of a parole framework that was legal error. If the court looks at the 3553A6 analysis, the disparity analysis, the district judge committed a pretty obvious legal error there, too. He compared the defendant's sentence to co-defendant sentences, not the nationwide disparity required by 3553A6.
I think the law permits you to do both.
It permits you to do both, but 3553A6, which is what he was referring to, and he said it implores him to do it, that refers to the nationwide disparity, and it also refers to federal nationwide disparity, not state nationwide disparity.
So I thought, isn't there a distinction between, I think our law says it's nationwide disparity is what is required to be considered, but district courts don't have to consider disparities among co-defendants, but they can, as I understand it. But then I think there's a separate caveat that it might be more categorical that they're not supposed to look to state sentences because those could be very different from a federal scheme, and it could actually enhance unwarranted disparity. So I guess I would distinguish between looking at co-defendants sentenced within the federal system, which may be allowed, and looking at co-defendants who are sentenced in state court for a different state law crime, which I might think our case law suggests is categorically prohibited. Would you agree or disagree with that?
So I agree with your second point, that the state law comparisons are categorically prohibited. I don't quite agree with your first point. I think judges can consider that. It should be rare that that applies. I mean, if you step back and think about it, that means that a defendant who is sentenced as part of a criminal organization gets a benefit from a defendant who's sentenced alone. I mean, it really shouldn't be the case that somebody who's part of an organization gets another notch in his argument because he has co-defendants, when if he had committed these murders alone, he doesn't.
Is that consistent with our case law, though? Because I thought our case law suggested that they're allowed, they're not required, but they're district courts are allowed to consider disparities.
It's consistent with your case law, yes. Your case law does allow it. I'm just saying that that's one, discretionary, and two, weak, especially when compared to 3553A6, which is the nationwide disparity point that the district judge just missed here. And on the nationwide disparity point, I mean, the things that the court looks to on nationwide disparity are the guideline range and especially the mandatory minimum. When we think of things that create a nationwide disparity, it's difficult to imagine something more than sentencing 20 or 30 years below a mandatory life sentence. So that's also a legal error, Judge Murphy, that I think we can point to, and it's similar to the one in Robinson.
We have these cases that come up. They're constantly going through the pipeline. And for the most part, when people are released, they're released. And we don't know what happens after. This time there was a stay. So how would you process the information that happened after? I mean, these cases, they end at some point.
So
even though the world is going on, even though people are vaccinated now.
I see my red lights on, Judge White.
Yeah, please answer.
I think in this context, because the situation is so fluid and because the appellate process takes a lot longer than the facts on the ground are evolving, it's a little bit different. I mean, let's take a couple hypotheticals. If a defendant was on his or her deathbed and miraculously recovered, the court might remand for the district court to consider that. I mean, conversely, if a defendant had a motion denied and then while the appeal was pending, something happened health-wise that showed this defendant was in imminent peril, that the court would probably remand there too. So this is just a little bit different I think, than what Your Honor is suggesting. Now, we just...
Do you agree with Judge Rogers that there's no limit on the number of motions that can be filed? So if new facts develop, a defendant who has been denied compassionate release can just file a new motion asserting the new facts?
Yes, we agree with that, Your Honor, and that's true that they can file as many motions as they want, and this court's docket will continue to reflect that, I think. I'm happy to answer any further questions. Otherwise, we'd ask that the district court's judgment, or order, excuse me, be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you.